This episode of Yarra Valley Yarns contains graphic material. Listener discretion is advised. This is Yarra Valley Yarns, Episode 3, The Hawker.
The earliest days of our community were days of hard work, limited resources, and for many, isolation. As communities across the Yarra Valley grew, so did the need for everyday supplies, access to which we take for granted today. Some settlers were lucky enough to have established themselves close to fledgling towns. Some settlers were more self-sufficient, whilst others knew all too well the difficulty of obtaining everyday goods, let alone the small luxuries, which made life in the 19th century all the more bearable. But it wasn't the lack of luxuries or the effort in sourcing supplies which made life trying at times. It was also the isolation. Often, a trip to town was as much a welcome exercise in social interaction as it was a chance to stock up on what was needed for the family, the house, and the farm. So, in those early days, it was the hawker who provided an indispensable service to those settlers who couldn't easily leave their properties. Hawkers sold everyday necessities such as clothing, food, and cooking supplies, such as flour and sugar, toiletries, books, general haberdashery, as well as luxuries like sweets and jewellery, all packed in their wagons, which were basically mobile department stores of the time. Not surprisingly, their visits were often met with great excitement. They also brought colour, friendship, and for many settlers, a lifeline to the outside world and a welcome distraction from the drudgery of work on the land. By the latter part of the 19th century, there were an estimated 200 to 300 hawkers operating throughout Australia, with the vast majority being Sikh and Hindu men from India. Often travelling in pairs, those who were selling goods throughout the colony of Victoria would collect their supplies near the ports of Melbourne and then travel with their horses and stock-filled wagons out across the hills and as far as their stock levels would allow, before having to return, restock, and then set out again. Not surprisingly, it was a perilous occupation, and this story is a tragic one. It's late 1890. Jugo Mull and his mate Fatter Chand, two Hindu men from the Punjabi area of India, have just arrived in Melbourne. They've been sponsored for their trip to Australia by Aru Khan, an Indian trader based in Fitzroy. Jugo and Fatter, essentially business partners, are both ready to sell their goods throughout the rapidly growing colony of Victoria, which includes the Yarra Ranges area outside of Melbourne. One of the many towns in which Jugo and Fatter sold their goods was Hillsville. Named after one-time Victorian Premier Richard Hills, the town itself was first surveyed in 1864 and was the first of several settlements dotted along what was known as the Yarra Track, a 120-mile road which stretched from Hillsville up across the Black Spur, down into the Acheron Valley and onto Marysville, the Cumberland and beyond. It was the main road which linked Hillsville to the Woods Point and Jordan goldfields, and also one of the many dangerous routes on which hawkers plied their trade. Not much is known about what really happened between Jugo and Fatter on their journey between Fitzroy and Hillsville. No doubt they would have sold stock as they travelled and nurtured their new clientele, to whom they'd return, perhaps on their next trip together. But Jugo and Fatter's time together as business partners was short-lived. There was to be no second trip. What is certain is that their story takes a very dark turn just weeks after their departure from Fitzroy, when, on the evening of the 22nd of November 1890, Jugo Mull became the victim of one of the most appalling murders ever committed in the colony of Victoria. It's known to history as the Hillsville Murder, and not surprisingly attracted all sorts of salacious coverage in the local and major metropolitan newspapers of the day.
You're listening to another great local story on Yarra Valley Yarns.
The first significant report of the murder was published in Melbourne's major morning paper, The Argus, on the 29th of November, 1890. The article is typical of the time, with its graphic, sensationalistic coverage of the story, which included every gruesome detail. According to that first major report, it was a Hillsville local, a Mr. Robert Allen, who was out walking in a bush paddock at the foot of Mount Riddell, who noticed some recently disturbed earth. He moved closer and started to remove some of the material. On closer inspection, Mr. Allen was taken aback as he uncovered the face of a man lying on his back, covered with just enough earth and gum tree boughs to hide him from view. An understandably shaken Mr. Allen at once reported the find at the Hillsville Police Station. Immediately, a party consisting of Senior Constable Devlin, Constable McLaren, Dr. Baird and other townsfolk proceeded towards Mount Riddell and the site of Mr. Allen's gruesome discovery. The Argus described, in minute detail, what was a truly horrifying scene. The torso of a man, lying on the bank of a small waterhole. The victim's head had several devastating wounds and was almost severed from the body. It was noted the arms had been removed approximately 6 inches from the shoulders and that both legs had been cut off just above each knee. Constable McLaren duly stripped off and conducted a search of the waterhole for the victim's missing limbs, to no avail. A nearby hut, some 300 yards from where the body was discovered, was a treasure trove of more shocking evidence. Inside the hut's fireplace were found pieces of burnt clothing, including remnants of a burnt vest. A £1 note was found on the floor, along with two coats and a pair of trousers. It was noted by police that the trousers and the coats all had their pockets turned inside out, indicating robbery as a motive for the murder. It was also noted the floor of the hut was raised quite a distance from the ground. An inspection under the hut yielded the victim's missing limbs. Two native trackers, summoned from the nearby Corranderk station, were able to detect the route the unknown killer took from the hut, as well as a spot where the killer undertook the mutilation of the body. A pair of boots and a blood-stained tomahawk were also found nearby. Although first thought to be part Indigenous, the victim was soon identified as an Indian male and as a hawker who had visited the Corranderk station with his business partner just a few days earlier. Dr. Baird deduced the victim had been dead about 3 to 4 days. According to the Argus, Jugo Mull was amongst a group of Hindu men who had arrived in Melbourne around August of 1890. Mull's business companion was also amongst them, described as being much taller than the 5'6" Jugo and of a much stronger physique. It didn't go unnoticed that Jugo's business partner was suddenly nowhere to be found. Immediately after their arrival in Melbourne, Jugo and his companion applied for hawker's licences, but were refused due to their lack of English skills. Despite this, both Jugo and his mate continued to work as hawkers, sticking to outlying country areas in order to avoid detection. 4 months later, they reapplied for their licences and were again rejected. But again, they continued to work, keeping a low profile. In late September 1890, the two men visited Aru Khan, the Fitzroy trader who had sponsored Jugo and Fatter's trip to Melbourne, where they replenished their stock and supplies, then set out on further travels as they headed towards Hillsville. Just days after the discovery of the mutilated body, the Argus coverage made it clear. Jugo Mull is the man whose mutilated body now lies at Hillsville, and his stalwart mate is the man of whom the police are in search. A substantial reward of £50 was offered for Fatter Chan's capture. Both men had been seen in and around the Hillsville district in the 3 to 4 weeks leading up to the murder. On the Saturday prior to the murder, the two men were at the Corranderk station. They left Corranderk around dusk before heading off in the direction of the hut at the foot of Mount Riddell. Robert Cohen, a Hillsville local, told police he had seen one of the men walking back towards Hillsville at around 10 p.m. on the Sunday night. According to Mr. Cohen, the man claimed he was lost and looking for the Hillsville Coffee Palace. That same man later inquired at the Hillsville station about the next train to Melbourne. After spending a no doubt restless night at King's Livery Stables, he boarded the following morning's first train to the city. According to the Argus, Aru Khan expressed his opinion on the motive for the murder, stating that Jugo would have had approximately £25 of stock and money, a small fortune, and most of it in cash. It made sense that Jugo's killer would try to get back to Melbourne, replenish his stock, and get back out on the road as soon as he could. Upon his return to Fitzroy, Aru Khan asked Chan where Jugo was. Chan claimed that he had left Jugo at Sandhurst, a place Khan knew that neither man had visited. Chan remained in Melbourne until the Thursday, before catching a steamship from the city to Geelong. It was reported that Chan was seen in the city on Princes Bridge and in such a hurry to board the steamer that he lost his turban. Police received credible information that Chan was on the Geelong-bound steamship and he was arrested soon after, whilst having tea at a farmhouse at Motorware. For the time, it was an extraordinary bit of police work. Fatter Chan was on the run for little more than 1 week. After appearing in court at Hillsville, Fatter Chan was formally ordered to stand trial for the murder of his mate, Jugo Mull. It was already an extraordinary story, but there was still much more to unfold as the Hillsville murder continued to provide gripping copy for newspapers all over Australia. The trial of Fatter Chan commenced at Melbourne Central Criminal Court on the 26th of February 1891, with Justice Molesworth presiding. The language barrier was significant and interpreters were needed for the proceedings. Fatter Chan pleaded not guilty, strenuously denying he had murdered his mate, Jugo Mull. In addition to the brutal murder of which Fatter Chan stood accused, it was further alleged he devised a scheme which would implicate another fellow hawker, Del Muhammad, in Jugo Mull's murder. Chan knew Muhammad and knew that he and Muhammad looked similar. He also knew the murder of Jugo Mull would soon be discovered. The scheme involved Chan travelling with Muhammad in the direction of Seymour. After embarking on their journey together, Chan soon deserted Muhammad en route and then returned to Melbourne, leaving Muhammad on the open road by himself. The scheme very nearly worked when Muhammad was arrested on suspicion of murder. It was also alleged that Chan had possession of several items known to have been owned by Jugo Mull when the two men left Melbourne several weeks earlier, including a hawker's licence which was given to Jugo Mull by another fellow hawker, Pierre Buchsch, when he left to work in New South Wales, his Victorian licence being of no use in the other colony. Chan was also found to be in possession of a small purse containing a silver chain with Indian characters, a chain which Aru Khan testified belonged to the murdered hawker. The prosecution mounted a convincing case, although much of it was circumstantial and a unanimous verdict could not be reached by the initial jury. But a second trial was soon underway. Chan's lawyer, Mr. Forlong, relied on a case of mistaken identity, attempting to discredit identification of Chan as it rested entirely on the evidence of Indigenous witnesses from Corranderk Station. When summing up, Justice Hood admitted that mistakes could indeed be made in terms of identification, but the evidence against Chan was substantial, albeit largely circumstantial. Justice Hood reminded the jury that despite two Supreme Court trials, Chan had never adequately answered where he was on the night of the murder, or what became of Jugo Mull after they had parted company. The attempts by the defence to discredit the police evidence was also condemned by the judge. Justice Hood admitted the jury, if they found that Chan had indeed murdered Jugo Mull, would need to convict him on the circumstantial evidence presented. After a three-hour deliberation, the jury returned a guilty verdict. The jury foreman added that they could not decide whether the motive was jealousy or theft, and could not recommend mercy for Chan. The prisoner was then sentenced to death and removed from the courtroom to the Melbourne jail next door. It was the 24th of March, 1891. It's not known if Fatter Chan's parents were ever informed of the truth about their son's crime and his subsequent execution. He was hanged at Melbourne Jail at 10 a.m. on the 27th of April, 1891. Like most of the other executed prisoners of the time, Fatter Chan was subject to a brief post-mortem examination inside the jail hospital and then buried inside the jail yard. A makeshift headstone was fashioned with his initials and execution date chiselled into a blue stone block set in the jail wall just above his grave. Years later, when the jail was being demolished, hundreds of prized bluestones were recycled for use in the fortifying seawalls at Brighton. Chan's makeshift headstone was amongst them, and it can still be seen there today. The small hut at the foot of Mount Riddell in which Juggo Mull was murdered has long since vanished, as has Corranderk Station. A small marker can be seen on Mount Riddell Road at Healesville, indicating where the station was once located. But there is one enduring relic of this sordid yarn, a relic of its time, and one which continues to help keep the story of Juggo and Fatter alive to this very day. Their story is told at the Old Melbourne Jail. The jail was in operation from the 1840s through to 1929. It has operated as a museum since 1972. Bruce Johnson is a tour guide at the jail. He says Fatter Chan's last weeks were controversial.
Now, when he was brought to the Old Melbourne Jail here, he would have been placed in an observation cell, and he would have been very closely monitored for the full 24 hours of the day. Now, because of Fatter Chan's religious beliefs, he decided that it was better for him to commit suicide by starving himself to death rather than being hanged. Now, he chose to commit suicide through starvation because his belief was that if he was hanged, well, then his spirit would then wander the earth for eternity with no rest or peace. As he got weaker and weaker, Dr. Shield had to force feed him through a tube through his nose, which stopped him from starving to death. He applied to the executive to have his death sentence commuted. However, it almost backfired on him, because the executive were most concerned that he may have starved himself to death before the day of his execution. So they seriously considered bringing the date of his execution forward. However, they decided that it should go the full time because there could be new evidence come forward in his favour. When Fatter Chan was told of the executive's decision, he told his interpreter that he'd accepted his fate and he was going to go to his death like a man and not like a woman. And it also bolstered his spirits a little bit as well, and he started to eat a little bit more. On the morning of his execution, he surprised everybody because he ate a very hearty meal of hominy, and he also asked for a chop, which he was given. At 10 o'clock, the sheriff demanded his body. The hangman came across from his cell and pinioned his arms behind him. He led him out onto the trapdoor and he pinioned his legs. He put the noose around his neck with the knot underneath his left ear and placed a white cap upon his head. And he was given the opportunity to say any famous last words. And through his interpreter, he said, "I did not kill this man, I am innocent." At which point the sheriff gave the hangman the nod. He pulled the white cap down over his face and operated the lever. The trapdoor opened and he fell to the end of the rope. He stayed at the end of the rope for the required time and the doctor declared that he had died.
Bruce leads me to cell 32 on the ground floor of the old imposing jail. It's just a few metres from the historic gallows where Fatter Chan and many other notorious criminals met their deaths. Inside a small glass display case is a macabre artefact.
Well, this is a death mask of Fatter Chan. Now, this was made about an hour and a half after his execution. Men and women were treated differently If you were a male, they would remove all your hair, whiskers and moustache, and they would oil the skin, and then they would cover the head in hot wax. They'd wait for the hot wax to set. Then they would remove the hot wax, put the pieces back together to make a mould, and filled the mould up full of plaster. It's a little bit unusual that he's still got some of his facial hair. You can still see some of his chin whiskers, some of his moustache, and a little bit of the hair on top of his head as well. That's the most unusual, because usually when they made the death mask, they shaved all that off. You can also see the marks around the base of the neck as well, where the rope was. When he was executed, death was instantaneous, which meant that the hangman had done his job fairly correctly on the day. And then they made the death mask almost straight away after the autopsy, just to make sure that the hangman had done his job properly.
Thanks for listening to this Yarra Valley Yarn. My thanks to the Seville Community House, Yarra Valley FM 99.1, Joe Cooper, and Kathleen Toohey and Bruce Johnson from the Old Melbourne Jail.
Yarra Valley Yarns is written, produced and presented by Matt Shaw and proudly supported by the Yarra Rangers Council.